Odo, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. Oh no, we're headed right for Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this here electronic engineering podcast hosted by me, Amelia Dalton. We may not be in Kansas this week, my friends, but we are certainly in the land of IP, where analog runs deep and there's always enough SoC design management to go around. Please welcome Cleosoft CEO Srinath Anathraman to Fish Fry. Srinath and I are talking about the hidden advantages of IP management, the challenges of global design teams, and how IP reuse can make all the difference in your bottom line. All right, my friends, let's go. Hello, Srinath. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Amelia. Thank you very much.
Okay, so to start things off, Srinath, give my audience a quick rundown on what Cleosoft is all about.
So we're in the business of helping semiconductor design teams collaborate and be more productive. So we looked at most of the EDA tools as being able to make an individual more productive. So we kind of think of ourselves are not in that space, but we're trying to make the team be a little more productive by collaborating better. When we started, revision control and design management wasn't something that the hardware designers were, you know, even considering at that point. Of course, it was a norm in the software engineering business. So we thought that we should bring the same tools and the same methodology to hardware engineers, but at the same time be able to cater to their needs. And typically software is made up of, you know, smaller text files. Most of the hardware engineers were not used to using the command line. They were dealing with large binary files. They wanted to be able to manage those things. And so we created a design management system that was, you know, catered much more for hardware designers, you know, essentially to be able to manage these large binary files without breaking your disk quotas, integrating with the design tools that they were working with rather than, you know, having to use the command line, even, you know, providing things like the capability to see what the difference between two revisions of a schematic are. You know, typically most of the software tools let you compare two revisions of a text file. Of course, that's not very useful if you're doing schematics or if you're doing layouts. So we kind of introduced the same concepts for layouts and schematics as well. So essentially for the first 10 years or so, it was very much a missionary sale. But at the same time, of course, we didn't have any venture funding, so it made it even more difficult. But all along, you know, we had to be profitable. Just so we have always been a profitable company. So now, of course, design management has become kind of standard practice. Even startups, we get so many startup new companies that become our customers. So they just deploy design management, you know, right from the beginning. And so we're now easily the market leaders. We have 300 plus customers, anywhere from startups to multinational enterprises across, you know, multiple design centers. And in fact, just last year, we added another 50 or so customers. And we also introduced a new product called Design Hub last year. And that takes essentially collaboration from a team level to an enterprise level. So it leverages all the IP in your enterprise, no matter which design center you're, you know, the IP was developed in or which business unit or which new acquisition has it. So we're trying to leverage all of that with Design Hub.
So Srinath, in a similar vein, there are a lot of hidden advantages in IP management, especially with companies having design teams all around the world. Now, your Design Hub and SOS 7 design management platform plays right into these issues, right?
Yes. So SOS is our design management platform. So we look at it typically as that's something that's helping a design team collaborate on producing some design. On the other hand, Design Hub is much more trying to leverage all the IPs that have already been developed in, you know, various different design centers.
All right, Srinath, let's talk about IP reuse. Now, what do you envision for the future of IP reuse? What do you see are the biggest advantages in the reuse of intellectual property?
So with Design Hub, we kind of thought of IP as much more than just silicon IPs. So we think that, you know, typically many of the large enterprises have so many different design centers and they have so many business units they keep acquiring. I mean, some of our customers have acquired so many new companies over the last few years. And so we see that expertise is trapped in various silos. Maybe it's trapped in a design center, maybe it's in a business unit, maybe it's just a group. So there's a lot of expertise that people are not sharing. And so we think of IP more broadly, not just silicon IP, but it could be best practices. Perhaps there's some script someone's written or some expertise. And so we feel that all of that is your IP. And if people are able to share that more efficiently and have a platform to allow people to participate and crowdsource all that information, then we'll be able to capture a lot of this. And so one of the things that happens often is some great engineer who has all this expertise either retires or leaves the company, and along with them goes their expertise. So what we're trying to do with Design Hub is to say, let's capture all or some of that. So at least by providing a platform where this person can, you know, share his expertise or her expertise with other people, that way all of that is captured in the system. So in the future, even if that person's left, you'll still be able to go find and leverage some of that expertise that's in the system.
So how does your IP reuse solution differ from other solutions available today?
Most systems we have seen today are kind of centrally managed catalogs. So, you know, you have some librarians who are managing all these IPs. And so if you want to publish an IP, you're going to have to submit it to that person or that group, and they will evaluate it and go through and then perhaps, you know, publish that. So there are many steps involved. It goes through a central system, and as with all central systems, you know, it is limiting. And so what we've done with Design Hub is try to democratize that. So we built an ecosystem which allows people essentially to crowdsource, to be able to say, just like Wikipedia or Stack Overflow have been very successful by crowdsourcing expertise from different people all around the world, what we're trying to do is do the same thing but for an enterprise. So essentially anyone can say, I think I have an interesting script or I have an interesting IP that I think other people in the company can use, then they can go ahead and publish that. And there's some value in that, in the sense that now, even for the end user, because the person who's publishing it, their fame, so to speak, has spread beyond their just design group into someone perhaps in a completely different design center on a different site. And so what we're trying to do is to say, let's not go through a central publishing authority. Let anyone publish. At the same time, we realize that different companies have different methodologies and what they want to do. And so small companies may be very open. Anyone can publish, anyone can use, whereas a large enterprise may have to deal with, you know, things like ITAR regulations. And so what we've done is we've created a very configurable tool. And the heart of that is what we call the workflow management. Whatever control an enterprise wants to place, you can do that. So, for instance, let's say you have a third-party IP, and to use that IP, you need to be able to sign a license agreement or get a purchase order. Now, you can build that into the flow. So as soon as anyone tries to download or access that IP, it presents you with a license agreement. Then once you're done, it might go to legal. Legal has to approve it before you get access. So that's just an example of what you can do with custom workflows. And the other thing we've done, of course, is to create hierarchical kind of traceability. So once you have the IP in the system, it tracks who else is using it. And, of course, it tracks it hierarchically. So when someone else wants to reuse that same IP, you know who else has used it. If you are using a third-party IP and you have an audit, you can very easily get a report and say, where has this IP been used? So it's good for legal purposes as well. And we've also integrated it into the issue tracking systems. So if there's an IP, there's a issue tracking system where it can go and say, what are the open issues with this IP? It can also do it hierarchically. It can say, okay, they're using all of these sub-blocks, so let me go look in all those sub-blocks and give you a full listing of every open issue for this IP. So essentially what we've done is created a ecosystem. And on top of all of that, we also have a forum discussion that's associated with the IP. Just think of it like Amazon or something where you're buying a product, but there's not enough information in the product description. So you can ask a question and someone who has used that product before can, you know, answer that question for you. And fairly soon it becomes a knowledge base with question and answers. And so other people can now leverage that information along with the product information. So what we've done essentially is created an ecosystem that gives you much more than just a static catalog. It gives you the capability to, you know, actually have a living, breathing entity where more information gets placed in it over time. And when you want to use it, you have a much better idea of the quality of the tool and of the IP and, you know, how it's being used by other people.
Now, you guys integrated your SOS design data management platform with Mentor's Tanner IC design tool. So tell me more about this collaboration. What is this integration by me as an engineer? And what are the other EDA tool integrations you provide?
So we've become kind of the de facto standard for the EDA industry. Anytime a company has a new product that they want design management for, they usually approach us first. Cadence Virtuoso has been an integration that we've supported for many, many years. We're not only a partner with Cadence, they're also our customers. So their IP group uses our software for managing their designs. Same thing with Synopsys. Synopsys, when they came out with the Custom Designer, which is, I guess, now called Custom Compiler, they approached us to provide the design management, commercial design management for their tool. We already supported Laker. Same thing with Keysight and ADS. They were looking to add commercial design management, so the only company they approached was us. And so we have now a large customer base of ADS users who use our design management integrated into ADS. We had an integration with Pixis and Mentor's Pixis tool. And so when they purchased Tanner, of course, they wanted commercial design management for Tanner as well. So Tanner, before the Mentor acquisition, typically sold to smaller organizations, which had probably did not have the same design management needs. Now that Tanner is being deployed by Mentor, they are getting into bigger organizations. And so, of course, the bigger organizations expect the same level of design management they are now used to with the other tools that they are using. And so Mentor approached us, and now we have an integration with Tanner, and this is just being deployed. And so, of course, it'll take a little bit of time before Tanner gets the new versions of Tanner are, you know, deployed in the larger organizations. And so once they do that, of course, then they will have all the design management and version control that they were already familiar with any other design tools that they were using.
Excellent. Okay, Srinath, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, I know you're a big science fiction fan, as I am as well. So what's your favorite science fiction book of all time?
My favorite book was probably something that I read many, many years back when I was probably in college or something. It was the Foundation Trilogy. I mean, that was a book that I read literally, you know, continuously through all the three books. And that was definitely one of my favorite books of all time. And I have to recommend a movie, Matrix, the first one, not the second and third, but the first one. Absolutely one of my favorite movies of all time.
Very cool. Those are excellent recommendations. Okay, Srinath, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Amelia. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to you.
If you have been a loyal Fish Fry fan or even a fair weather Fish Fry fan, you'll know that we love our drones on this show. And this week, my friends, we're flipping the script on our drone coverage. What about a drone that you could control with your mind? Yes, let me introduce you to Kickstarter Corner and the U-Drone, the ultimate mind-controlled drone. And no, this isn't some kind of magician, David Copperfield, David Blaine kind of business. No, this drone is actually commanded by brain electrical impulses. So no joystick, touchscreen controls, or VR headset, my friends. With this bad boy, all you have to do is wear the U-Mind light, the brain-sensing headband, concentrate real hard, and the U-Drone lifts off. So it's actually in this headband where the mind control magic happens. Not only did the U-Drone team incorporate some pretty beefy algorithms into that headband, but they also built in a whole bunch of different sensors. There's an EEG, or electroencephalography sensor, which measures electrical activity in the brain. An EOG, or electrooculography sensor, that measures eye movements by monitoring the electrical potential between the front and the back of the human eye, and an EMG, or electromyography sensor, which measures electrical activity in response to a nerve stimulation of muscles. It also has gyros and accelerometers and other patented gear that is used to amplify its signal and quiet some of the noise from our brain and nerve sensors. So, in short, this headband can not only read your brain waves, measure your brain electrical activity, track your slight facial movements, but also convert these signals into instructions to control your drone movements. Awesome, right? Okay, so what's all included? Once you have gotten your concentration level to 150, the drone will whirr, rise, and buzz through the air with zero delay. You can change the altitude just by thinking about it. Adjust the flying direction by tilting your head right or left, and land the drone by biting your teeth. With its AI camera system, you can just blink your eyes twice and the U-drone takes a photo. And you can also set its gesture recognition function auto mode by just flashing a peace sign. So somewhere in the middle of the FAQ for this Kickstarter campaign is listed the following. In addition, the powerful AI camera system of U-drone automatically adjusts camera focus, exposure, and position to ensure your face is ideally displayed in the frame. All you need to do is act naturally. Sure, act naturally with a plastic headband pinching your temples and a drone buzzing around your face. Sure. So, the U-Mind Light headband and drone do charge via USB, as you can probably imagine. And there is an accompanying U-Drone app that lets you set the drone to mind control mode. So, fine print time. You can throw them $10 and get a special thanks from the U-Drone team. Nothing else. Okay, so the next level of the campaign, you can get just the drone for $149. But really, where's the fun in that? So, for the full mind control kit and caboodle, it'll cost you around $300. And for around $1,200, you can get a fleet of 5 U-drones to impress your family, friends, and local podcasting host. So if you want to sign up to back this mind-boggling Kickstarter campaign, I've included a link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. And if LinkedIn is more your thing, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. Oh, and don't forget, our Twitter handle is EEJournalTFM. And we have a YouTube channel, keyword EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of super cool techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series, hosted by yours truly. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can check out the Fish Fry archive or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of March 15th, 2019, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.